Hello and welcome to Earshot. I'm David Rutledge. Thanks for your company today. And this afternoon, our program begins 40 years ago, when the Whitlam government, in its dying days, pushed through Australia's first human rights law. 1975 saw the passage of the Racial Discrimination Act, and this paved the way for a series of laws addressing issues around gender, disability, and age. But over the past four decades, the Racial Discrimination Act has been under constant challenge. It's as controversial today as it was then, and the same questions are still being asked. Should we use the law to modify human behaviour, and do such laws stifle free speech? This story from producer Lorena Allam.
It's a battle that spans four decades.
This is the story of the Racial Discrimination Act.
Any attempt to mix races is a bad thing.
This is a day many people didn't think would arrive.
There's been some confusion over exactly what Mr. Colwell meant when he said he didn't want to see a chocolate-coloured Australia.
The end of the White Australia policy and the introduction of the Racial Discrimination Act were interlinked.
On the northern tip of Queensland, there are celebrations tonight to mark the end of an epic battle for Indigenous land rights.
Had that case decided the matter in a different way, you may well have seen the very rapid demise of Australia's first attempt to legislate for human rights.
It is a modern fallacy that virtues such as tolerance, decency, and fairness can be imposed by legislative sanctions.
They could not have been certain that this piece of legislation was even constitutional.
If Queensland legislators will not do away with these obsolete and offensive limitations of civil rights, the Commonwealth will have to do it for them.
Now, I've spoken to John Kuata, a courageous Aboriginal person, but a person who's not well and who desperately wants to have his land and his land for his people.
It was declared a national park back in the 70s, so as far as that's concerned, it's water under the bridge.
I always have said in my heart, I thought he's beside me, but he missed out.
That's Martha Kuata talking about her late husband, John Kuata, a man sometimes referred to as the Mabo of the mainland. In the early 1970s, John Kuata began a legendary fight with the Queensland government to try and buy back the land of his birth at Archer River on Cape York. Mr. Kuata won the fight in law, but he also lost in a spectacularly hurtful way, as you'll hear later in the program. But Mr. Kuata's case decided the fate of our nation's very first law about human rights. The Racial Discrimination Act did not have an easy birth in 1975, but it stands out like an exclamation mark in our history, an extraordinary way to announce to the world that we had finally ended the White Australia policy. Dr. Gwenda Tavan teaches history at La Trobe University.
The achievements were both important in legislative terms, but also very significantly in cultural and symbolic terms. And when you look at the debates around the Racial Discrimination Act, what you see is, you know, a very strong emphasis by policymakers on the fact that not only would this provide protection for vulnerable groups and individuals in our society, but it would send a really important message to all Australians and to the international community that Australia had shrugged off that past and that history of race discrimination, and that effectively a new chapter was beginning.
There were, as there are now, racist elements in society which simply had no interest in anti-racism legislation.
Professor Sarah Joseph is the director of the Caston Centre for Human Rights Law at Monash University.
People who honestly would have perceived this type of legislation as a blow at their way of life. I mean, racism these days, it certainly hasn't disappeared, but it fortunately is widely recognised as a very bad thing. That wasn't necessarily the case back in the 1970s. I mean, we weren't long gone from the White Australia policy, the White Australia immigration policy. The Freedom Rides were in 1965, which exposed extremely vile racism in the country. And so racism was prominent, and so there would have been a lot of resistance simply on the basis that some people were racist and wanted to continue to be racist.
Well, you see it in your Australians, you see the houses around in Fairfield and that. You see what they're like, they're filthy and dirty and everything. They've got millions of kids.
I just don't think they should be here.
We're all supposed to be brothers and sisters, aren't we? We all come from the one creator.
It is likely to be counterproductive to adopt policies that provide special benefits for persons simply because they belong to a particular section of society, differentiated by race, colour, ethnic affiliation or sex, rather than on the basis of individual need or merit.
There were other arguments as well. For example, there was a libertarian type of argument that it simply wasn't for government to legislate for, if you like, moral behaviour, that that the government shouldn't be telling people, you know, that even though people might agree that racism was a social evil, it wasn't an area where the government should be legislating.
You really can't abolish prejudice by passing a law. The most important provision in the Act and the Convention of the United Nations is to carry out programs of education, information, cultural development and research to combat prejudice in our country.
In fact, it was the Conservative Holt government who signed us up to the UN Convention to eliminate all forms of racial discrimination way back in 1966. But until Whitlam came along, governments were reluctant to build the convention into domestic law. There were strong debates about whether Australia even needed such a law.
Yes, it is very interesting to see some of the internal discussions within government circles about, A, whether racism existed, and then, B, the extent to which Australia should publicise this in terms of its accounting to the United Nations. Some documents that you look at in the archives make very clear a desire to reject any notion of discrimination, and others that were a bit more open about what was happening at a state level in relation to Indigenous Australians or also in immigration policy.
A lot of people would say that what you're saying is an outmoded concept in a modern world and in a new type of world.
Yes, I suppose there would be some people that say that. They would be educated nongs. They would be pseudo-intellectuals, the sort of people who are trying to force their views on our society generally, and they want to change things. And I'll never let them or never encourage them or never help them to change.
You'd fight them?
I've always fought any attempt to dilute our blood.
There were some arguments, I guess surprising from the point of view of 2015, that there was in fact no racial discrimination in Australia and therefore this was a piece of legislation aimed at solving a problem that we didn't have. There was even one extraordinary argument by one senator, a Senator Ian Wood from Queensland, that even if there was racism, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing, that somehow the experience of racism is something that reinforces fortitude and character within the target.
Of the two bills the Attorney-General, Senator Murphy, introduced into the Senate yesterday, one seeks to guarantee basic human rights and freedoms, the other to outlaw racial discrimination.
There was another argument by a National Party senator from Queensland, Senator Scheel, arguing that the countries that legislated against racial discrimination, and the examples he used were the US and the UK, that they fared worse than those that had in fact legislated for it, such as South Africa and Rhodesia. I should add that Senator Scheel's support for apartheid later deprived him of a ministerial position in the Fraser government.
It's more than token sympathy. Neville Bonner knows only too well what it's like to be a displaced person.
Well, people will never understand that as an Aborigine, I've been playing politics since I was about 4 years of age, just to survive.
There was a very interesting moment when Senator Neville Bonner, who was the first Indigenous member of Parliament, a member of the Liberal Party, he reminded members that they weren't really in the greatest position to judge whether racial discrimination existed or not, nor were they in the best position to judge, you know, what it felt like.
Unfortunately, there are very few people within the party who will even now accept the fact that I am an Aborigine, and I think like an Aboriginal, I feel like an Aboriginal. My earliest days of really feeling the bitterness, I suppose, was when I'd sing that little ditty, God made the little nigger, he made him in the night, he made him in a hurry and forgot to paint him white. Funny to them, funny to their parents, because even the parents would laugh. Wasn't funny to us.
Order.
The first draft of the bill that was introduced was quite ambitious in its aims. It wanted criminal penalties for breaches of the Act. It wanted the Race Commissioner to be able to initiate civil action. It wanted criminal offences for inciting hate crimes. All those provisions were eventually dropped. They were the compromise points, if you like. And this compromise was reached through quite intense debate over a significant period of time, in fact, almost 2 years.
The Racial Discrimination Act has been in force since late last year. This week, I spoke to Al Grasby about his act.
We've got a choice of being the most erudite people in the world by the year 2000 or the most ignorant.
Both parties in principle supported non-racial discrimination, but what was ultimately achieved was a highly compromised piece of legislation that didn't ultimately reflect all the aspirations and values of its creators, but had to placate the concerns of various members of the opposition and of the Senate.
Lionel Murphy had introduced it in 1974. It wasn't passed then, and in 1975, Kep Enderby introduced it. I can imagine that there were elements within the ALP which were resistant, but they had probably been worn down by Whitlam's reformist instincts and his control of the party. The Liberals and Nationals were a broader church. There were certainly some strong supporters, such as Senator Cheney, Senator Fred Cheney, Senator Neville Bonner, and many others. There were some who were against, but at the end of the day, the Liberals and National Party needed to come on board in order for this legislation to pass the Senate. And it did, in fact, pass the Senate. And that achievement can't be underestimated. I mean, remember, this was passed in one of the most contentious parliaments ever, only a few months before. Or in fact, the Senate basically brought down the Whitlam government.
When the House has come to order,
it's still a pioneering effort as far as Australia is concerned. It was pretty important that we do it. 83 other countries around the world had endorsed the United Nations Convention, ratified it. We hadn't. For the first time in our history, it is now illegal to discriminate on the grounds of race or ethnic background or colour.
The Racial Discrimination Act became law in June 1975. Meanwhile, an epic land rights battle had been brewing on Cape York between the Wik people and Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen, a battle that would determine whether this new law would live or die.
Martha, yes. Do you want to grab some of the little kids with you or something? Like
that? Oh, yes, Lauren.
A Wik man called John Kawata and a number of other stockmen wanted to buy the Archer River cattle station using funds provided through the Aboriginal Land Funds Commission. The station was on their traditional lands. They approached Remington Rand, the American businessman who owned the pastoral lease, and he agreed to sell. But the Queensland government blocked the sale, saying Aboriginal people already had enough land for their use and benefit. Mr. Kawata said this was racially discriminatory. In reply, Queensland said the Racial Discrimination Act wasn't valid. Greg McIntyre is a barrister who's practiced in areas of racial discrimination and native title for about 40 years.
As a young solicitor, I was given the file when I first went to Cairns. I mean, the history before my involvement was that John Kawata had met with the Aboriginal Land Fund Commission chairman and they had agreed to purchase a pastoral lease and then the Queensland government had said, oh no, we're not agreeing to the transfer of the pastoral lease because we're not agreeing to any more grants of land to Aboriginal people. Al Grasby was the Commissioner for Race Relations and he sought to conciliate it. The Queensland government Crown Solicitor advised that they weren't going to participate and Grasby then issued a certificate which allowed the legal proceedings to commence. And I went up to Arakoon and met John Kawata, and we then immediately moved them to the High Court because the Queensland government were alleging that the Racial Discrimination Act was beyond the constitutional power of the Commonwealth.
This is AM. Good morning, I'm Red Harrison. One of the High Court's last decisions with Sir Ninian Stephen on the bench was to uphold the Racial Discrimination Act in the face of a challenge by the Queensland government. According to Senator Neville Bonner, the decision means the highest court in the land recognises that...
The interesting issue for the High Court to grapple with was whether a Racial Discrimination Act, which was the domestic implementation of an international treaty, was within the Commonwealth's power. So the obvious argument from the other side, from the state of Queensland, was, well, how is this an external affair? It's something entirely within Australia. And then the other issue was, how can it be a special law with respect to the people of a race when, in fact, it affects all races? It didn't succeed on the racist power, but what was remarkable about the Kawata case constitutionally was that the High Court was prepared to say that when Australia implements its international obligations, then that's part of Australia's external affairs, and therefore to enact legislation within the Commonwealth of Australia is an exercise of the external affairs power.
What effect will this have on the morale of Queensland Aborigine, Senator?
Oh, a tremendous effect. There's great elation amongst the Aboriginal people already that finally the highest court in the land has recognised their claims and has recognised that there is discrimination and it must be eliminated.
Had it gone the other way, and it was a 4-3 decision, had it gone the other way, what would have happened to the RDA?
It would have been declared invalid. We wouldn't have a Racial Discrimination Act.
And that, Greg McIntyre says, would have dramatically altered the course of Australian history. In clarifying a crucial matter of constitutional law, the Kawata case paved the way for major social change.
The Tasmania Dams case would have been lost. The Mabo case would have been lost. So it was a very significant case for constitutional law and in a range of social and economic and political issues.
By 1982, Mr. Kawata had won. His case had guaranteed our first human rights law, clarified complex matters of constitutional law, and laid the foundations for the Mabo case, which Greg McIntyre was also involved in.
..in the law, and it will put the Queensland government in its place, in effect. It now will not be able to use its paternalistic, bureaucratic, racist laws against Aboriginal people in this state.
Senator Neville Bonner.
But the Queensland government had one last trick to play to stop Mr. Kawata getting his land back.
No sooner did we win that and think we were about to go on to actually get a result for Mr. Kawata than Joe Bjelke-Petersen's government converted the pastoral lease into a national park, effectively pulling the rug out from under our feet.
And was there anything you could do?
No. Effectively, that was the end of the case. I mean, that effectively gazumped us.
As John Kawata later complained to one of the original High Court judges in the landmark case, Sir Ninian Stephen.
After I won that case, they turned that international park, which I can't go.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. So that you're really no further advanced as far as ownership of the land is concerned.
Yeah.
The Winchinam people and the Arakoon people had to wait until the Native Title Act came along and they were able to claim that land back as native title, but by then, of course, John Kawata had passed.
On the northern tip of Queensland, there are celebrations tonight to mark the end of an epic battle for Indigenous land rights. The Wikmungan people on Cape York Peninsula have been given their land after a struggle...
Mr. Kawata passed away in 1991. It took another 20 years for Queensland to unlock the gates to his country. In 2010, Premier Anna Bligh passed a law revoking part of the national park.
This decision puts an end to a shameful chapter in Queensland.
Then in 2012, her successor, Campbell Newman, finished the job. He went up to the Cape with the title deeds in his hand and an unexpected apology.
Today I want to confront the issue that is 35 years ago a great injustice was perpetrated. And today we're here to put that right. We're here to make sure that it is right forever and to give back to people what was rightfully theirs. I'm sure if all Queenslanders knew the story of what happened in 1977 and afterwards, they would feel as sorry as I do myself. So today, my apologies to those that have suffered.
People have waited a long time for this recognition. We, as WIC families, we knew that we're from that country, but it's been a long and hard fight to get that recognition from the outside world, from the mainstream world. Sometimes it might seem a little arbitrary from the southeast corner why that sort of recognition is important. It's important because we're from that country. We're the custodians of that country. It's our job to look after that country, and we're a part of that environment. It holds all of our culture, all of our stories, all of our sacred sites, and it's our role to look after those areas on behalf of those ancestors who have passed on. So thank you, Premier, thank you, Ministers, thank you everybody for coming up today for this momentous occasion, and thank you to all our other families, Ayapattu and Southern Kanji families as well. Thank you,
Bruce. Bruce Martin, John Kawata's nephew, speaking at the Handback in 2012. So Mr. Kawata's case is closed. In its 40 years, the Racial Discrimination Act has been amended, refined, and it has survived. But the challenges to the RDA continue.
The way the law has operated in the past 20 years has also established that the threshold is very high. Mere slights are not enough to be considered under 18C. You need to do something that causes profound and serious effects.
How often do cases go to court, though, realistically?
Not very many cases get to court. So in the 40 years that the law has been in place, there have been only 180 cases which have been determined by a tribunal or by a court. Fewer than 10 cases went to court involving the RDA last year.
Dr. Tim Soppomasan, the Race Discrimination Commissioner. You'll hear more from him again this time next week when we fast forward to the present day. How can a domestic law possibly keep up with the new world of social and anti-social media? What is racism these days anyway?
I am not a racist.
When we think about what racism is, we immediately discover that nobody's quite sure. They're fairly sure if it hits them in the face.
There's no question that this is a profound challenge, and it's a lot more difficult to address or to respond to because social media is ubiquitous.
I don't believe there's ever been entrenched racism. I mean, you've only got to look at the racism that exists from the Aboriginal side back towards the police or back towards the white person.
And things can be communicated instantaneously and to larger audiences. And those audiences are global.
It was a day of protesters protesting against other protesters.
What we're looking for are practices that allow us to sustain a certain degree of civility in a complex multicultural society.
Hold your line! You are a disease!
And increase the sense that people have of the fairness and responsiveness of the system.
Back and forth, and there's been the occasional scuffle as they press right up against the police line.
It's important for us as a society to be able to have a mature and sober debate about race when it does emerge from time to time.
We're trying to spread a message of anti-racism.
These days we accept that racial discrimination is a terrible thing. We accept that sex discrimination is a terrible thing. But in lived memory, they were not viewed as terrible things, and they were in fact viewed as normal, except, of course, by those who had to suffer it.
Submissions already received include evidence of firebombings, serious physical assaults, bricks used to smash windows, and the slashing of car tyres.
The target tends to be women. The target does tend to be women who are visibly Muslim, so those who wear the veil. More alarming is the fact that we've had so many incidents which have happened in the presence of young children. Definitely concerned about my safety and the safety of my family, but more broadly I'm concerned about where we're headed as a nation.
Mr. Kuwata's Case, that was produced by Lorena Allam and Timothy Nicastri. And I hope you can join us again next week for part two, which looks at cyber racism. Thanks to Peter McCutcheon, to Dr. Tim Soo-Pomasan, and to Rock and John Spence from the ABC Archives.